It's a daily vlog, but as one of my readers just reminded me, not on Saturdays and Sundays. Well, thank you, Guy, for that introduction, and thank you, Brian, for this great invitation. 3 years in coming, actually, this invitation. Ladies and gentlemen, I've been delivering a version of this speech for almost 2 decades when I think about it. I've spoken about the purpose of speeches and their unique ability to change human hearts and minds all over the world for years, all over the U.S. and Canada, several times in the U.K., including in one of the early years of this conference in Bournemouth. Once I was invited to the United Nations to give a talk to what I was told would be a very small coterie of people who were involved in speeches at the United Nations, maybe 15 people, I was told. And I got there and 300 people attended that speech. It's a different speech for 15 people and 300 people. So why do I keep getting invited to talk all over the world about speeches? Perhaps it's because, as my fellow American writer Mark Twain once said, the definition of an expert is someone from out of town. But the last time I talked about the purpose of speeches was during the whirlwind year of 2019, when I shared many of the same ideas and examples I'm going to share with you now. I shared them with speechwriters in Sydney, Australia, at the invitation of the federal government of the Dominican Republic, with a group of public and corporate officials at the first ever All Africa Summit in Gaborone, Botswana, and at the PSA World Conference in Washington, D.C. with my friend Benjamin Knight. The speech was a big hit everywhere I went. People seemed to agree with my central message that physical, in-person speeches have a special, magical, and irreplaceable power. And I was scheduled to give that speech here in the spring of 2020, but we all know what happened then. The cancellation of my speech and all other speeches for a year, then 2 years, and kind of into 3 years. So what was lost? Was my message still true? Or had Zoom put the lie to my message about what only a speech can do? Ladies and gentlemen, we're about to find out together, right now, right here. I'm going to deliver my speech, mostly unchanged, from what I told those people all over the world 3 years ago. And we're going to see how it sounds to us, how it sounds coming out of my own mouth in a room full of unsentimental, pitiless scientists of rhetoric. That's you. And we're going to see how it lands with all of us if this still all makes sense. And I hope for all of our sakes that it does. Are you ready to begin? It's a breathtaking pace indeed in human development and in human communication. President Kennedy used that speech to announce my country's intention to send a man to the moon. I plan to use this speech for a much more modest purpose, to try to explain to you why, despite all the developments in technology and mass communication, I am still standing before you today as I might have done 50,000 years ago to give you a speech. And more to the point, to explain to myself, perhaps, why you are sitting there patiently, willing to let me give it. To be honest with you, I think this is a talk that I've been preparing to give for a long time now. Maybe ever since I became interested in speeches and the people who write them and the people who deliver them. Maybe actually long before that. Maybe actually when I was a little kid and I was actually bored as hell by most speeches. Remember the speeches you heard when you were a kid? Speeches were terrible. Starting in elementary school, when our teacher made us stand up in front of one another and make arguments we didn't believe in to fellow students who couldn't have cared less what we said. That's what speeches were. I was bored by speeches in the United States at independence rallies where speakers asked us to be grateful for our freedom when our childhood lives seemed like anything but freedom. Sit up straight, elbows off the table, no more cookies, time to go to bed. What was this freedom? I was bored by speeches at school assemblies. The high school superintendent was always going on and on about excellence and success. And I thought, speeches aren't communication. Communication happened in much more intimate settings, in a car with your mother or father, or at a sleepover with a friend. Communication I loved. Anything that wasn't communication, I hated. So why have I spent most of my career studying speeches? Because I've spent most of my career growing up in understanding and coming to understand the meaning of being a human being. To explain to you and myself what speeches can do and why we give them, we have to go back 50,000 years just as President Kennedy did. That's when the first speech was given. The self-appointed leader of the first cave community had some information she wanted to get across. She'd climbed up to the top of a ridge and spotted a herd of mastodons on the way, very far off, but on this coming in this direction. She scrambled down into the cave and told the first person she ran into. When she was sure that person understood, she told that person to tell somebody else, and she told a fourth person. Well, soon the cave was just a cocktail cacophony of just contradictory conversations, and that's when the cave woman became impatient and shouted at the top of her lungs, "Everybody shut up!" I've got something to tell you, and I'm going to tell you all at once. And with that, she made the first speech. It was short. It was to the point, and it was not nonsense. It was communication. There's a herd of mastodons coming. If you want to eat, I suggest you sharpen your spears. Thank you for listening, and now I'm pleased to take your questions. And that's what speeches were for roughly the next 49,500 years, though they became more elaborate and more persuasive and more rhetorically sophisticated thanks to people like Aristotle and Cicero. Speeches were efficiency devices, more or less. I don't have time to talk to everybody individually, so gather everybody, and I'm going to tell everybody at once. Then this came along, the Gutenberg Press. Now, if you had something to say, everyone didn't have to come to you at a certain time. You could put it on paper and send it to everyone else, and they could read it at their leisure. Then a few hundred years later, still the blink of an eye in the human history, came the advent of radio. Now, a leader could be heard to deliver a message, which allowed my country's president, Franklin Roosevelt, to use his voice rather than just his words to people to convince Americans that the only thing they had to fear was fear itself. And they allowed Winston Churchill to share his determination in the face of long odds with the sound of his voice that we shall never surrender. Then came television. Now, a leader could not only be heard to deliver a message, but he or she could be seen delivering a message. So what did the British people see when they saw that? They saw a nervous and shy young woman, an unsure young woman, but a very serious young woman, and they watched her confidence grow before their very eyes. And then at the end, they saw that very sweet and charming smile. Are we finished yet? They saw their queen. Over the next decades, through televised speeches, people became accustomed to hearing what their leaders sounded like and seeing what their leaders looked like as they delivered words of inauguration and farewell, words of calls to arms, and calls for peace. Then the internet came along, then YouTube, then streaming, which made it possible for leaders to deliver messages anytime they like. The cave woman had gone viral. But okay, so now, what is the social function of a speech? The speech, which began in its function in society as an efficiency device, gather everyone around so I can tell them something important all at once, now a speech is just about the least efficient method of communication that I can think of, this one included. Every video you've seen or will see during this talk is available on YouTube. I could have very easily recorded this speech from my home office and sent it to each of you via email, and you could have gotten all the information. You could have gotten a sense of my personality and my interest in this subject. And you could have done it all without having to sit there and sit still and come all the way here. And you could have done it when you feel like it and not when it happened to work for Brian's schedule or the university's schedule. And you could have done it with a beer in your hand. But no, you inconvenienced your family. You inconvenienced your colleagues. You disrupted your routine. You took time out of your work to come here and sit still and listen to me. Why? Why do we still give speeches? And why do we still go to them? Is it just out of force of human habit? We've been doing it for 50,000 years and it just hasn't occurred to us to stop. I asked that question seriously, actually. Speeches might be like that. They might be ancient social rituals that will one day seem silly, superstitious, or even barbaric, like animal sacrifices or public executions or eating a family dinner without going on Instagram. Maybe. But that's not how it feels to me. Here's how it feels to me. It feels to me as if the purpose of speeches has fundamentally changed. It feels as if speeches are no longer for delivering information, although they can do that. It feels as if speeches are no longer for persuading people to change their minds, although they can try to do that. It feels as if speeches are no longer for sharing an original vision, although they can do that, and in fact, maybe I'm trying to do a little bit of that with this speech today. But so what are speeches for now? A wise speechwriter I know, an Australian named Lucinda Holdforth, that's a good name for a speechwriter, Holdforth. Lucinda Holdforth says that speeches aren't for what happens inside us. She says speeches are for what happens between us. She quotes the novelist Franz Kafka, who said that the purpose of a novel is an axe. He said a novel is an axe for the frozen seas within us. Lucinda says that speeches are an axe for the frozen seas between us. Between us. Between me and you. And more importantly, between you and one another. I believe a modern speech is a modern speech, not when the audience is looking attentively or even admiringly up at the speaker, but when the speaker says something to cause audience members to turn and look at one another, or at least be conscious of experiencing the message, the words and the sounds and the sights and the magical mood in the room and the ideas in one another's company. How does this work? Well, you've seen this next speech before, but this time you're not going to watch Martin Luther King. You're going to listen to the crowd in the background. I mean, that audience doesn't sound like they're at a speech at all. They sound like they're at a music concert. That can't happen on Zoom. Watch it happen with this next speech as well, which is a little closer to home for you all. This is Charles de Gaulle's a famous 1962 visit to Germany, where he famously spoke in German. And this, keep in mind, this is less than 20 years after World War II. Watch this crowd. These people are literally bouncing off of each other. I spoke of a speech being a speech when the speaker says something that causes the audience to look at one another. That's what that is. That also doesn't happen on Zoom. Speech does another thing that no other medium can, another thing entirely. It offers an opportunity to prove one's courage by physically showing up and standing before what might be an indifferent or maybe even a hostile audience. It's a lonely thing to stand in front of an audience, and in just so doing it, a speaker gets real credit from that audience for doing it. It's a physically courageous act. I'd like to share the best example I know of a speaker showing up and standing and delivering a difficult message. Some of you may know this story, some of you may not. It was April 4th, 1968. Robert Kennedy was running for president of the United States. His brother had been shot and assassinated 5 years earlier. And he was making a routine campaign stop in Muncie, Indiana, and he was about to get on a plane to deliver another routine campaign speech in an all-African-American neighborhood on the south side of Indianapolis. As he gets on the plane to go from Muncie to Indianapolis, he learns that Martin Luther King has been shot in Memphis, and as he gets off the plane in Indianapolis, he learns three things: that King has died from his wounds, that his campaign staff expects this event to be canceled. They're obviously not going to go in and do a campaign speech. And three, that the police refuse to escort the campaign in there anyway because it's rumored that unrest is happening or is about to happen across the United States as a result of this news being spread. And Kennedy says, "I have to go in. I have to go in. I have to say something. I can't just leave. So I'm going in." And he goes in against all advice. And he gets on the back of a flatbed truck to the people who are all gathered there. He gets on the back of this flatbed truck. And as you hear this begin, if you listen closely, and it might be hard to hear, but on this, because you have to listen closely to the main thing. But if you can listen closely to this video, and this is on YouTube, he says, "Do they know about Martin Luther King?" And somebody says, "We've left it up to you." So that isn't an example of a perfectly crafted piece of rhetoric, but it is an example of what only a speech can do, to give a speaker a chance to communicate physically by showing up and searching for the right words, even looking nervous, feeling nervous, not sure what he's going to say. He showed up and he stood there and he spoke. And that's what speeches can do. On the spot, I traveled down there a few years ago, tried to find the spot where this happened. It was in a park on the south side of Indianapolis. And in the southwest corner of the park, there's this wonderful sculpture that still stands there to this day. And that there's a ceremony every year commemorating this moment in important American oratory. So I often share examples like this of American speeches like this, and I share them in Europe, and I always hear the reply, well, that's great, but it would never work in our culture. The idea being that that European and British speakers are loath to share personal anecdotes and origin stories connecting their humanity with their position in life. And I agree that American speakers generally warm to this more easily than speakers in Europe. But however speakers like to present themselves, audiences, British and European audiences, are not fundamentally different from American ones. Audiences at a speech, especially audiences at a speech where by someone who would lead that audience, they really want to know two things, and these are the two things they think they can get by coming to a speech in person. First, what makes that person special? Why is she up there and I'm down here? And they want a really good answer to that question. They want to know, oh my gosh, she's up there because she's brilliant and she talks about this and she cares about this, and they want that to be a really solid, concrete answer. They want to know exactly why the speaker's up there and they're down here. But they have another question that's just as important that they want an answer to simultaneously, and that is that special person up there also enough like me that he or she understands my problems, understands my needs, understands my community? They want to know both those questions, and they think that by going and seeing somebody in person, they have a better chance of figuring that out than they would in a more remote setting. And that's what a speech can do. And so, obviously it's a different style, European versus American. So let's look at how one European leader used a much different and more reserved style to get his humanity across at a TED talk a few years ago. Some of you I know are familiar with this speech. It was written by a speechwriter, a woman by the name of Annelies Breedveld, a wonderful speechwriter, by the then chief of defense, for the chief of defense of the Netherlands at that time. And here's how he tells his story in an entirely different style.
With an old gun, not even the best marksman in the armed forces could have hit the mark.
So you see what he's doing there. He's doing exactly the same thing. He's doing it in a very different, more reserved style. But he's showing people at once that he is competent, but that his competence and his choices and his whole way, his whole life is built on his passion and on his own humanity. So what do speeches do? They only do what needs to be done in our society, in our increasingly electronic, remote, fleeting, and fluttering, and just divided society. They allow leaders to offer their ideas through their humanity. They connect people to leaders in an authentic and lasting way. And they connect people to one another in an emotional and even spiritual bond. Speeches don't do much anymore. They only do what our society needs most. They help us connect with one another. And I think that's why I was invited. And I think that's why you came. I think I probably did not teach you anything that you did not learn, that you did not already know personally. But I came in the hopes that I could possibly teach you something that you have not heard communally. Lucinda Holdforth has a wonderful book on leadership communication called Leading Lines. In the introduction, she marvels at how we still give speeches, even in this age of distraction. And here's why, she thinks. Perhaps it is because there is some rough magic in the communal experience of listening, and a grace that comes with giving an individual the opportunity to speak their considered thoughts aloud in the welcoming presence of others. We come together to breathe in tandem, to experience our own responses and feelings alongside each other. And sometimes, if we are lucky, and if the speaker speaks truly, in deep connection with one another. We come together like this because to speak freely and to listen attentively is to be human, to express a core human capacity and a central democratic freedom. I hope that I have spoken truly today. I thank you for listening, and I'd like to leave you with a meditation, a deep and to me a very emotional meditation by a speechwriter on the power of speeches. We heard Robert Kennedy speak earlier. Here's an interview with his speechwriter, Adam Walensky, about a speech and what it meant 50 years ago. I hope it means something to you today. And I would say that all political leaders in their own personal style, appropriate to their own culture, in their own way, all leaders need to talk more like that. Thank you, everybody.